I-44, the wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, Saturday night, partly cloudy with a low around 30. The wind will be light and out of the north. Sunday, mostly cloudy. Expect a high in the mid-40s. The wind light and from the north. Sunday night, mostly cloudy. We'll see a low in the upper 20s. Monday, mostly sunny with a high in the mid-40s. Monday night and Tuesday, mostly clear. Expect a low Monday night around 30 and a high Tuesday in the upper 40s. At noon Central Time, most locations across Illinois and Indiana reporting a sunny sky and temperatures in the 50s. At Rockford, it was 52, 51 at O'Hare, Bloomington 54, Mattoon 54, and in Carbondale, it was 57 degrees. South Bend reported 46 degrees at the top of the hour. It was 55 at Lafayette. In Indianapolis, 57. In Terre Haute, 56. Willard Airport reported a sunny sky at the top of the hour, 56 degrees. The dew point, 35. The relative humidity, 45%. The wind out of the southwest at 20, with gusts to 25 miles per hour. And the barometric pressure, 29.76. And falling. And at 12:38, 54 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. We have a sunny sky. Obesity is hitting Latino children in the U.S. harder than any other demographic, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Angela Wiley, a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, is trying to curb that trend in immigrant communities living in Illinois. She heads the Up Amigos Project, which looks at how biological, social, and environmental factors affect rates of obesity and diabetes. Illinois Public Radio's Rachel Otwell recently spoke to Wiley about her research.
There has been an uptick, I believe, in the incidence of diabetes in Mexico, but the rates there have consistently been higher than in most other places in the world. So we know that there is a genetic component to diabetes in Mexico, and that seems to be perhaps made worse when Mexican citizens go elsewhere or when they obtain more contact with westernized food and lack of physical activity.
When they move to the United States, changes in diet and things like that might kind of amplify genetic issues that are already there?
Yes. We also see patterns within Mexico that also lead us to think that is the case. So, for example, the rates of diabetes are still high but lower in more rural areas, and the further south you go in the country. So the closer the populations are to the border with their neighbor to the north, the higher the incidence of diabetes. We know there's some synergistic effects going on.
So if you could just kind of pinpoint the prevalent cultural takeaways, what would they be?
Well, one of the reasons that we are so passionate about Up Amigos is that we're looking at youth. So our feeling is that if we're going to impact the prevalence of diabetes and metabolic syndrome, heart disease in this population, we need to make some changes among the youth. So one of the, areas for future research and probably intervention is this idea of educating Mexican parents about the importance of their late adolescents and early adult children being physically active. So we did not collect data on the reason that the conflicts are happening, but we did do some follow-up explorations that will kind of lead us to do some future studies. In some of those follow-up explorations, we were able to find out that Mexican parents, many of them might believe that physical activity competes with other things that their children should be doing. So, for example, when their kids are applying to university, they may feel that their children should be studying. Additionally, the other huge cultural emphasis is on family. So there may also be this sense that physical activity competes with family time. So while we need to do a lot more work in this area, those are two candidates for why we think this relationship might exist. And they give us a lot of food for thought about where we might begin to intervene.
Looking at the data that you've already collected and into the next 5 years or so, do you see these figures getting better or worse?
Well, I think that will depend a lot on the extent to which we are able to both educate the population, but then also provide access. So a lot of the immigrant communities that live here in the United States have a serious access issue when it comes to healthy food. And so there's a lot of food insecurity, which doesn't necessarily in everyone's mind immediately go hand in hand with obesity, but there is a connection. So we've got a lot of work to do on multiple levels, I think, before we're going to actually see a downward trend in a stable kind of way.
That was U of I Professor Angela Wiley speaking with Illinois Public Radio's Rachel Otwell. For more information about the health and wellness coverage you hear on Illinois Public Media, visit our community engagement website at willconnect.org. New unemployment numbers are out today. The Labor Department says the unemployment rate fell again slightly to 8.5%. That's the lowest level in almost 3 years. Another survey finds employers added almost 200,000 jobs. In addition to hiring, many businesses are spending billions of dollars on lobbying this year, as in every year. Businesses could spend their money on many other things, so that raises the question, what's the payoff? Here's Alex Bloomberg of NPR's Planet Money team.
What you get in return for the money you spend on lobbying is a difficult question to answer with precision.
We know that people lobby for a reason. We know that they're successful many times, but we haven't really been able to quantify what's the return on their lobbying investment.
Raquel Alexander is a tax professor at the University of Kansas. A couple of years ago, she and her colleagues set out to answer this question. It's a tricky one because there are a lot of reasons people lobby, and you can't always put a dollar figure on what they get out of it. The NRA lobbies for gun rights. The Sierra Club lobbies for environmental issues. If they get some regulation strengthened or loosened, there's no easy way to tally up what it's worth. But in 2004, Alexander and her colleagues finally got something that could help them add up lobbying costs and benefits, the American Jobs Creation Act. This was a piece of legislation that lots of multinational corporations spent a lot of money lobbying for because it got them a huge one-time tax break. It allowed them to bring profits held abroad back into the country. And instead of paying the normal rate of 35%, they paid just over 5%.
So we found 450 firms that reported in their financial statement that they were taking advantage of this tax holiday to bring money back home. And of those, 93 we identified as being involved in lobbying.
Alexander and her colleagues compared the amount these firms spent lobbying with the amount they saved on their taxes and came up with a figure they called the return on investment to lobbying. Now, return on investment is a term you may have heard. How much do I get back in return when I put my money somewhere? Money in a regular old savings account, you'd be lucky to get a 1% return on investment. On the other end of the spectrum, Bernard Madoff advertised annual returns of just over 10%. So if you want to come up with a big, impressive-sounding lie, a 10% return on investment is what you say. The return on investment to lobbying, in the case of Alexander's study?
22,000%. So for every dollar on average that these firms spent on tax lobbying, they received $220 in tax benefits from this repatriation provision.
Were you expecting it to be that big?
I was not. I was not expecting it to be that big at all. I thought I needed to go back and check my math again.
So after the fifth or sixth time checking, you were like, oh, this is the number.
Maybe after the 20th time of checking.
There were $3.5 billion spent on lobbying in 2010, and it's hard to imagine that every one of those dollars got a 22,000% return. There are certainly companies out there that spent a lot of money and didn't get what they wanted. They just lost the money. But Raquel Alexander says that since that tax holiday passed in 2004, the amount of corporate profits held in offshore tax havens has tripled.
Because people that weren't doing this before are doing it now, and the ones that were doing it are doing even more.
What do you make of that?
I make of that that everyone agreed basically that it wasn't going to be a one-time provision. They knew it was coming again and that they would be able to bring some of this money back home.
And in fact, in May of last year, the Freedom to Invest Act of 2011 was introduced in the House, setting up a one-time tax rate of 5% for offshore earnings. In October, a bill doing the same thing was introduced in the Senate. Now, when it comes to the corporate income tax, there is a healthy academic debate about how high it should be. Many experts say we'd be better off if corporations paid a lower income tax. The money they saved on taxes they could put into investment, which would ultimately lead to more jobs. And as it happens, Raquel Alexander and her co-author on the study, Susan Schultz, come down on separate sides of this debate. Alexander thinks the 35% corporate tax rate is about where it should be. Schultz would like to see it lowered considerably. But Schultz has a lot of problems with the way it got lowered in this case, through lobbying.
We have a situation where we, in essence, invite corporations to buy their own tax rate through lobbying, making their own deals with Congress, which I think ultimately corrupts both the companies and the politicians.
The coalition of companies lobbying for the new tax holiday has spent around $50 million so far. Companies in the coalition are estimated to have over $200 billion in profits parked offshore. For NPR News, I'm Alex Blumberg.
Barnes & Noble stock took a tumble yesterday. That happened after the bookseller announced it's exploring separating its Nook e-readers from the rest of its business. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
On the heels of a holiday season that saw a 70% increase in sales of most Nook devices, Barnes & Noble says it wants to unlock the value it has built into its tablet business. The company said it would not comment further on its intentions, and Sarah Rotman Epps, an analyst with Forrester Research, says no one is quite sure what a separation might mean for Barnes & Noble.
Shareholders look for growth, and the Nook business has driven growth for Barnes & Noble. If Barnes & Noble spins off that business, what is there for shareholders to be optimistic about?
Epp says there is also some concern that the company's interest in separating the Nook from the bookstore is an indication that its core business is not doing well. But Epp says separation could be a good thing if it just means that the tablet business will be independently managed.
If that's the arrangement that Barnes & Noble is envisioning for Nook, this could be a great thing. It would give the Nook business more independence to attract new investment and new partnerships, to expand internationally, to innovate more quickly.
Whatever Barnes & Noble has in mind, says Epps, it's important that it builds on the support the store has provided for the Nook, as well as its good relations with the publishers who provide content for the devices. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 6th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of E.L. Doctorow, born New York City, 1931. His first novel, Welcome to Hard Times, a satire of the Western. His second, Big as Life, science fiction. It was his third